Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Martin Indyk. I'm the Vice President and Director of the Foreign Policy Program at the Brookings Institution. And I'm very glad to have the opportunity to welcome you. This is not our normal digs. Next door, our auditorium is being renovated, so you have to excuse us, but we're very happy to have an opportunity to host you on behalf of the African Growth Initiative at the Brookings Institution. Especially on this occasion, we are very honored to have the opportunity to host President Kenyatta and his distinguished delegation of ministers on the occasion of the just concluded US-Africa Leaders Summit. It's been an amazing whirlwind week, showcasing the opportunities that Africa has to offer, and that is no more the case than, of course, in the great nation of Kenya. I'm particularly glad that we have in attendance today some of the strongest supporters of the Africa Growth Initiative, particularly representatives from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, also Ambassador Godec, the ambassador to the Republic, our ambassador to the Republic of Kenya, and Ambassador Michael Battle, who has been so active in organizing the US-Africa Leaders Summit. The Brookings Institution's Africa Growth Initiative is a research effort dedicated to producing high-quality, in-depth policy analysis to generate innovative solutions that promote Africa's economic development. And as part of this goal, the Africa Growth Initiative has established a multi-year partnership with the Kenya Institute for Public Policy Research and Analysis. The African Growth Initiative and KIPRA, as it's known, have conducted a number of joint research initiatives over the past 4 years, and they have an ambitious agenda going forward. We're very honoured to host President Kenyatta today for a discussion on Kenya's economic growth trajectory, regional integration, and security challenges, as well as President Kenyatta's ongoing efforts to unite his people under the new Kenyan constitution. After we have a chance to hear presentation from President Kenyatta, the director of AGI, Mwangi Kimenyi, will serve as the moderator for a conversation with the president, both at the podium and with questions from the audience. His Excellency President Uhuru Kenyatta was elected to the presidency in March 2013, last year. He ascended to this role after a very distinguished career in public service, first as the Minister of Local Government, then as Minister of Finance, and then as the country's Deputy Prime Minister. Since his election, he's pursued an ambitious policy agenda, prioritising efforts to promote national unity and regional security, as well as to improve Kenya's education, public health systems, through the fulfilment of the country's long-term development plan, which he has labelled Vision 2030. In addition to his domestic leadership, President Kenyatta also serves as the chairman of the East African Community, the EAC, which has made the most progress out of all the regional economic groupings in Africa towards the stages of the African Union's plan for regional integration codified in the Abuja Treaty. At the EAC, President Kenyatta has championed important efforts to accelerate those commitments. Under his leadership, Kenya has also partnered with a number of flagship US government programs. Kenya today is a lead collaborator in our USAID's Feed the Future initiative, the Obama administration's new Trade Africa program, as well as Power Africa, which will receive $12 billion in new commitments from a variety of stakeholders announced during Tuesday's US-Africa Business Forum. Ladies and gentlemen, As I said, it's a great honor to have the opportunity to host President Kenyatta, and I would ask you to please join me in welcoming him to the podium.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Let me begin by saying it's a pleasure to be here. And as has been said, at the tail end of what I believe has been a great week for the African continent and a great week for the United States from two perspectives. One, we've always had a partnership. But I think for the very first time, we're trying to crystallize this partnership in a form not of dependence, not of Africa coming to your doorstep with our problems, with our demands, with our sorrows and our woes, but Africa coming to the table, offering a hand of partnership, opportunity, and newfound hope. A couple of years ago, I had the opportunity to have another opportunity to be right here. And many of the things we possibly be talking about today, we weren't talking about then. It was never very clear where either Kenya, East Africa, or Africa was really going. But I think over the years that story has changed. That story has developed. And today, when I say I truly believe that Africa is clear on where it wants to go, I believe many in the world have seen that. I believe many in the world have already started participating in that trend. We've had a certain story told about what Africa has to offer. We have certain positions that have been taken about what Africa is all about. And unfortunately, that story has stuck in many ways similar to kind of like a broken record. Yeah, you don't want to really think differently. You hear the word Africa, you hear the word Kenya, you know, we know about that. Yeah. And this really hasn't even been helped very much by the perceptions that are maintained by our media. And people haven't even sat back to reflect and ask themselves a very simple question. Wow, these are not stories that are born and brought out by foreigners. These are stories that are brought out by Kenyans, by Africans. What does that mean? When I was here many years ago, I mean, one of the main issues was, you know, people being journalists in jail, lack of freedoms, lack of this. But today, who's telling the story? It's our own people back at home. What does that mean? When we were here talking about lack of media freedoms, where are we today as Kenya in terms of those freedoms? That means something. Something's changing somewhere along that particular path. When we were here, we were talking about civil society in chains, in dungeons, in everywhere. Where are they now? They're here addressing you. and telling you what they think, telling you what they feel, telling you what they wish to see in their home country. And they're not saying it as refugees. They're boarding the KQ flight and flying here, finish off with you, and then they're flying back home and continuing with their business. Something's changing somewhere. But we're still stuck on that broken record. We haven't yet moved from that record. Then all of a sudden, here we are saying, oh, China, China's moving into Africa. Oh, Africa's moving to China. Nobody sat back and said, wait a minute. The Chinese, for all they may be, are probably the shrewdest business people I've ever seen on this planet. They're never going to do anything unless it's in their interest. So they've seen something that nobody else has seen. They've taken advantage of something that people still stuck on a broken record haven't yet latched onto. So Africa's moving. It's moving with Chinese money. It's Chinese contractors. It's Chinese companies exploiting resources. Chinese companies building railways and highways all across the African continent. And then as it happens, because I keep repeating this broken record, yeah, the only way that could be happening, yeah, is because they're bribing those corrupt African governments. It's not the other way around. If they're bribing corrupt African governments, they're not bribing them just to give them money. They're bribing them maybe because there's something they're getting out of it. Huh? Because the truth of the matter is that Africa has changed over the last 20 years. And Africa's changing, and it's changing at a pace far greater than any other corner of this globe. Africa is creating opportunities. Africa is learning from their own mistakes, from her own mistakes. Africa wants to chart a completely new path. Some of the world's most reformist constitutions, not some, I think the only, that can be found anywhere on the globe are on the African continent, and Kenya prides herself to be one such country, with a constitution second possibly to none in the world in terms of the rights that are enshrined in that constitution. And as a small country less than 50 years old, if we look at the ages of many countries, yourselves who have been around for over 200 years, the United Kingdom that's been up and down for the last 1,000, having us as part of their colony who still don't have a constitution to date. This is what we've done in the last 50 years. We've still got challenges. No, nobody denies that. Big ones. But what have we done, even with the limited resources that have been available to us? Look at what's happening in health. Look at what's happening in education. Look at what's going on in infrastructure. Why don't we abandon Her Majesty's voice? You know that old gramophone that used to sing to us all the time, huh? And recognize that here's a continent that's really possibly grasped more onto the digital world than the first world. Here's a country that's coming up with innovations that are being copied, that are being patented, and in some cases even bought over and taken over by first world companies. this is a country or a continent, and let me talk about it in general specifics. When we sit to dialogue, we'll be more Kenya specific. Where the most advanced forms of banking can be found anywhere in the world. We are expanding our financial inclusion on a digital platform, in many ways far ahead of the United States itself. Many, many ways. We have apps being built by young Kenyans that are being sold for millions of dollars to some of your own companies. They're actually Kenyan or African applications. But yet, within that whole mix, there are some who are beginning to grasp and to latch on to these possibilities and opportunities. And that's why especially a number of major corporations, U.S. amongst them, especially those ones that rely on talent, are actually growing their presence on the African continent more and more each day because they're seeing this happen. But the traditional thought is still way back on the broken record. We were having a chat a little earlier when we were talking about the headlines. Despite the fact that here we are at a historic moment of a major conference between a continent of great opportunities and a country that prides itself on opportunity. And yet, what do the headlines tell us? They talk to us about Ebola-affected summits. God Almighty, I mean, yeah. Ebola is there. And as was said, for those who are mistaken, that is a global crisis. It's not an African crisis. Wake up to the fact that, deal with it. Otherwise, it's going to be on your doorstep. It's not an African problem. It's our problem. It'll be on your shores tomorrow. But we can deal with it. Like together we dealt with AIDS and other things. These are issues that mankind has to deal with. And we used to blame you for creating AIDS and transporting it to us in the continent. Nah, but didn't stick there and moan about it. We said, let's deal with it. And I think as a globe, as humanity, we've really focused ourselves on dealing with that problem. And I think we're winning that particular battle. And we'll win it, just like we can win this one, if we actually figure out that these are problems that we need to solve together. So I really don't have much to say today. I think we're here for a conversation. Huh? We're here to discuss. My only plea is, please, let's start changing the record. Let's start recognizing that, yes, problems are there. I'll be the first to admit, problems are there. But for the first time in the history of independent Africa, you're getting more and more governments clearly understanding that we have got to change, and we are in the process of changing. And change requires support. Criticism, yes, but it requires more support in order for it to be sustainable. And that's why we say what we seek are partners to help us turn our challenges, which are real, into opportunities, not just for Africa, but also for yourselves. And it is that partnership that's going to help us develop a kind of world where, you know, we all share in mutual prosperity and create a peaceful, stable, inclusive, participatory, democratic world. But it's not going to happen overnight. And we've got to remember that every single journey, no matter how short or how long, begins with the first step. Africa has taken the first step, and Kenya specific, we have taken the first step. Thank you very much.
I sit on that side. You'll be wired.
Thank you, Mr. President, for joining us again. Last time you came, you were finance minister.
That's right.
So we thank you very much. And we are privileged that you came back to visit us. And I would also want to thank Martin for welcoming our president. Martin, our vice president. And also he didn't mention that he is the immediate Obama special envoy to the Middle East, Israeli conflict, and I think it's pretty hot out there. So he's back with us. So thank you very much, Mr. President. We don't have a lot of time, and I would like to give the audience to really come up with the questions. And I would like to focus on four different, very important areas that are, to Kenya and actually to the continent. The first one, I would like to talk a little bit about internal and external security. The second is on regional integration, for which you have become a real champion. The third is on the Kenyan economy. You started on that, but I would like us to have a general overview. And I also like to focus on the implementation of the new constitution. I would like probably to focus more specifically on devolution, which was a key aspect of this. So, nevertheless, I would like you to start by probably giving us your view. You started on that, but what you consider to be the most important aspect of this summit that you see the successes. Just briefly, you mentioned, it was a big thing, but could you specify a few areas where you think you have made progress? As Brookings, we are very happy. We made recommendations like that we would like to see this going beyond Obama so that it is institutionalized, and that was one of the points that they have taken, among others. So we are also very happy about our contribution. We were working with the administration. So would you comment briefly on that?
I think the first thing is to say that I think this has given us, as I said earlier, an opportunity for us to actually have an engagement as two continents. It has, with the American government being part and parcel of the organization of this summit, it has created a certain degree of awareness, especially amongst corporate America, and allowed attendance at the highest possible levels. Indeed, as was said by one of my colleagues, I mean, it's really the first time, because we've had trade missions, we've had countries coming out on road shows to try and sell their various destinations. But we've never really been able to engage at the kind of levels that we were able to engage at this time. Secondly, it's the very first time that there's been an engagement at a summit level that involves not just corporate America, but also corporate Africa. Right? The two coming together with a clear understanding that governments are here to facilitate the partnership between the private sector on the African continent and the private sector in America.
Good.
So I think that's the first
success
and clear goal. Second, many of us were very concerned even when we were coming. This was going to be a monologue.
Yes.
Of a talking down to. But what clearly impressed everybody, especially after yesterday, was that it was clearly not a monologue, but a dialogue.
Great. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And an opportunity for Africa to get her point across. Huh?
Good, good.
Equally for the United States to pass on their message. Yeah, and to see how the two messages could come together and get a very categorical way forward. So I think, whereas the perception, as we were talking about before, in terms of the way, or the media, or the general public, has taken the whole situation, I think at the decision-making level, we have reached a place where we're not talking at each other anymore. We're actually talking with each other.
Good.
And to me, I think that is
your success.
The most important milestone of this. I'll give an example. We, you know, for the first time, you know, if we look at Libya, for example, you know, there was a position that had been taken by the African Union.
Yes.
And there was a position that was taken by the U.S. and our other Western allies. Yesterday was the first time we were able to look each other in the eye and say, okay, this was the African Union position. President Obama was there saying, well, this was our position.
Yeah.
Right? And to look at both sides of the coin together on the same table. And this is necessary, yeah? In order to build a spirit of trust and mutual confidence. Yeah?
Excellent.
So I think, without getting into the specifics
that's fine.
Has happened, you know, in terms of the business meetings or this or that, I think just that ability to be able to sit and frankly exchange with one another was very useful, and hopefully this will be the beginning, of a regular interaction of partners, and to me. That is a fundamental importance.
I think that's excellent. Yesterday. And we were very worried that this was going to be a one-way conversation. And I'm glad to hear that that was a dialogue. Okay, let me go ahead and ask on some specific questions that you are directly involved in. And this one has to do with on security. External threat from Al-Shabaab, which seems to be costing Kenya dearly. Yet Kenya continues to be the host of thousands of Somali refugees. Kenya Defense Forces are still in Somalia. This seems to have become a Kenyan problem, while it's really an international problem. What is your take on this, and what's your view on the role of the international community? Do you think the international community is doing enough? And what do you say about the permanent travel advisories that seem to be costing the country quite a bit? Okay, just brief. Come.
Let me first agree with you that this is not a Kenyan problem. This is not a regional problem. This is an international problem. And I say that because terrorism doesn't have boundaries. All it has found at this current stage and moment in time is a home somewhere along the borders of Kenya. And tomorrow,
to move.
It is very easily relocatable to a new home, possibly close to the borders of the United States. It has no home. Mm-hmm. It is where the environment is conducive. So consequently, you cannot tackle the problem of terrorism as a country-specific or as a national problem. It is an international.
Yeah.
It is an international problem. When terrorism first reared its head, Kenya was nowhere on the radar.
Yeah.
And I like to in many instances recall that, you know, America, Western Europe, and many other parts of the world suffered from terrorism. And to remind a lot of people who've probably forgotten that, yeah, that at that time, when it was never an African war, yeah, we stood in solidarity with the world at that particular moment in time. It's now shifted and found a new focus, be it on the Kenyan borders, in Nigeria, in Mali, in Syria today, in Iraq, and Libya. If we're not careful in the direction that they're going, it's going to find itself a home there as well. Yeah? And we have to acknowledge that the same war that you fought when it was on your shores is the same war that we're still fighting today. And Africa today is fighting that war with a lot less resources available to us, yeah, than those that were available to you. And I think that issue came out quite clearly yesterday.
Okay.
Because to me it's been a concern because, and I've said it severally, that sometimes we feel as if this war has been left as our war. But I think I'm happy to say that today I can see, let me just speak specifically about the discussions that we have had with our partners here in the United States. I think there is acknowledgement that we need to do more together to combat this.
Yeah.
There are concerns that have been issued and raised about the manner in which possibly we are handling this whole issue, the way we are tackling this terrorist threat.
Yeah.
So, you know, issues and concerns, you know, the whole human rights and etc. issue. Issues that we are totally in agreement with. Do you know, if you have a piece of land,
yeah,
and you need to eat, yeah? All right?
Yeah.
There's the person who has the combine harvester that, you know, plows the land, sows, fertilizes at the same time. But then there is that individual who has nothing more than just a hoe. Yeah?
Yeah.
So the man with a hoe will be a lot more rudimentary.
Yeah.
But our aspiration is to be able to plow the same way as maybe you would plow with your combined harvester. So rather than say, hey, okay, you're not handling it right, look at us and say, how can we help you? How can we work together?
Yeah.
Yeah, so that we can combat this in the same,
yeah,
in the same manner. Because the objective ultimately is for us to be able to deal with it in a proper manner.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, you've got to first of all look at the tools that are available to,
yeah,
to each other, and rather than criticize me, say, I want to help,
yeah,
Uru get this plow that is going to be able to get him to get a better yield from his farm while still achieving,
yeah,
you know, the same objective. And that's where the partnership yeah, comes in. We want to do this thing. We want to do it right, right?
Yes.
But we need to work together. We need to get the support for us to be able to do it together correctly, right? So this really is the encouragement. That's why I'm saying, you know, through discussion, through dialogue, if we're not talking at each other, but talking with each other, we get that understanding, yeah? We are able to tackle a problem together, do things in the right manner, but get the end result. And what is the end result? Eliminate terrorist threat, not just from Kenya,
yeah?
From the globe, right? That's actually what we all desire, right?
Good.
Let's just work together and see how do we do it in a manner that is acceptable to all of us, right?
Yes.
Because we all want to get to the same
end point. Good. Thank you very much. I know that the audience is probably getting anxious because they want to ask questions, but I may have to skip some. But I would like you to comment. We'll tolerate a little bit. I wanted to cover the general ground. Okay, on the internal security, we have a domestic security problem, especially at the coast. This appears quite unusual. Is this contained, and do we know what the root causes are? Could this be reflective of emerging new organized crime, or is it a political problem? Again, brief on this.
I think the two are intertwined, and I've said that in the past. One, we have a problem that is historical in nature, a problem of grievances between communities, a problem of grievances of underdevelopment, problem of grievances. What is quote-unquote historical injustices, all right?
Yeah.
Which, I need not repeat, this is something that is well on the radar of everybody, and all of us know the peak of all that and the resultant situation in the 2007-2008 elections. This has underpinned the call, the desire, the drive for a new constitutional dispensation to deal with some of these issues. And as a result of what happened, there was a fast-tracking and a sense of urgency to bring this about. And we managed to get to a position where in 2010, as a republic, created, got ourselves a new constitutional dispensation, which really aimed at not only dealing with the issues of historical injustice, right, but pushed us towards trying to create this more equitable society where rights were clearly defined, protected, and safeguarded, so that we would be able to address ourselves to that past and now look towards our future, in a much more cohesive, united manner. We're in the first year of implementing that constitution, right? So let's not say that these underlying issues have been dealt with. They have not yet completely been dealt with.
They're not easy.
So we are in the process now of addressing ourselves to those, be they land, be they... you know, marginalization or whatever. But, and we still have those forces that still feel we need these issues addressed.
Yeah.
At the same time, right, you have this threat of terrorism that is finding its way in.
Yeah.
You know, the Al-Shabaab threat. There comes a time where some of these groups get what you might call a marriage of convenience.
Yeah.
Right? Where people feel I am unjustly treated and maybe give. I may not believe in the terrorist ideology, but we share a common end goal. You know, I want to get rid of these upcountry people instead of looking and saying, but by the way, to deal with those historical injustices, let's sit now as Kenyans and address themselves.
Yeah.
You get these terrorist movements trying to take advantage of that. Right? And that is why I'm saying we need to first and foremost be able, because, and there's been a marriage, or what you might call a marriage of convenience between these two forces.
Okay.
And that's why we are desirous to separate.
Yeah.
Let us deal with the terrorism threat and move them out.
Thank you.
Let us now focus on dealing with the local grievances, yeah, in accordance with the principles set out and the institutions laid out in our new constitution. All right? So if it is the question of land, for example, on the coast, you don't need to go and join Al-Shabaab to sort them out. You now have a constitution that allows us to be able to concretely deal with these issues in a much more permanent manner. You have those, that avenue is now open to you, right? We don't want to brush them back under the carpet. We're just saying you don't need to have Al-Shabaab to support you to deal with that. You have this constitution. Let's address this challenge. If it is a question of unequal development, we now have the counties. Let us nurture these counties. Let us get the institutions going so that we ensure we get equitable medical facilities across the country, you know, proper extension services, so that the issue of marginalization is adequately dealt with. We have the framework now.
Yeah.
Yeah? We don't need to go to the extreme end to deal with those issues. Yeah. If it is a question of equity in terms of it, we have a constitution that is very clear. Yeah? On gender parity, we have a constitution that is very clear, on ethnic parity. If you have problems, you can go to, there are institutions that you can go to seek redress.
Yeah.
We don't need to go to a violent end to get redress.
Yeah.
So this is why I said that of what is happening, we see a convergence of a negative force, and a force that is using a negative way of achieving their agenda. We want to separate the two. We want to eliminate the negative force that is coming to reign terror and deal with the genuine problems that have existed in a manner, that is clearly laid out in the Constitution and say, you have genuine grievances, we acknowledge that, but we want to address them, but we want to address them in a peaceful, permanent manner.
Good.
Yeah? You don't have to resort to to giving Al-Shabaab, somewhere to sleep or facilitate them. You don't have to do that. You have now institutions
to deal with that.
To deal with those problems of yours.
Thank you very much. I'm going to open to the floor, but there are so many questions I would have liked to answer, but I'm assuming the audience will ask. I was interested in covering the East Africa community, particularly your very fast tracking of a monetary union, which is to me a bit worrisome. I wanted a commentary on Trade Africa. You have already mentioned that. I wanted to hear a little bit more of a view of the economy, which you covered quite a bit about all this, and I wanted to see how the gender and youth strategies are working out so you can weave it in with some of the questions coming from the floor. I was very impressed by your proposal about converting dead capital of land in particular Kibera. I haven't heard much about that, so if you could weave it in some of these strategies, it would be very interesting, because I thought it was an ingenious way of solving this. Then I'll ask you, and then I'll overall coverage of devolution, which will come up. But let me ask me my last question, which will be, this will be my last question. Please. Because it's something I don't understand. One of previous President Kibaki's notable achievement was infrastructure. Your government seems to be keen to do more in this area. Last week, you announced that the government intends to almost double the number of tarmac roads, a real ambitious plan. Now, you said that you are going to use a new strategy, the annuity financing framework. I confess I had to go and study this one, but still I had some gaps. You stated that this approach has an advantage because in the past, and I quote, weak contractual arrangements provided a perfect opportunity for briefcase buccaneers and cowboy racketeers to masquerade as contractors.
The problems of the internet, everybody knows.
While freezing the taxpayers. contract. So how exactly is this going to help us with dealing this problem? And it can be brief, and I can start asking someone to start passing the microwave. So go ahead and that one answer. Tell me how these buccaneers and briefly.
As briefly as I can.
What is this financing?
What we were saying is, how have we conducted or carried out our infrastructural development in the past?
Mm.
What we have done is largely relied on budgetary allocation. So you say, I'm building a road from here to there. Huh? So it's budgetary allocation, right? Then you've gone out to tender.
Yeah.
Then you've had a procedure and a process, where you do the design, right? Possibly, again, through collusion, you've done that design to suit a particular
contractor,
all right, who you've had a deal with, right? Then that contractor goes out. Within that same contract, you've got all sorts of different penalties that are charged and levied for late payment, and this and that and the other. Huh? Then again, there is still that same collusion that when the time comes for payment, there's a delay in payment, and then you hear there is a 30% surcharge, 30% monthly surcharge. All right? Okay?
Mm.
So that by the time it's paid, you've seen that that contract has almost doubled or tripled. All right? To the point where you've reached a stage where you have road projects that are ongoing, never complete, always stalling because there's never enough resources to see them through. That's sort of generally been the way it's been done. So what we have said, and that's, I believe, one of the main reasons why it's been slow.
Yes.
Not only slow, it's filled with corruption also. And those are the buccaneers and
the cowboys
that we're talking about.
Yeah.
So what we've said is, let's change this model.
Yeah.
Let's involve private sector. Let us say that I want to build a road now from Nairobi to Narok. Right? I'll go out and say, I want to do this road. Let me engage private sector. Say, I want you to design a road to this specification, right? This many kilometers, right? From here to there, design it and build it, all right? Then I'll put that out. Let people go out and compete. And on top of it, get your own finance.
Oh, I see.
Go out and compete, right? Then we get a three-way arrangement where as you get your finance, they say, okay, this is the person who has designed the road, right? Because now they're going to be competing amongst each other, right? The person who's designed the road has got the best finance, best capability, best time framework, etc., including maintaining the road.
Which is a problem we have.
For a period of time. Mm. Then the arrangement that you have is that the person builds the road, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then you, through your budgetary allocation, instead of setting aside 2, 3, 4 billion to pay, you will be paying and servicing, right, as a government, whoever has won. Yeah? You the government takes on the role of servicing that loan, basically. Right?
I see.
Okay? And you can do a series, a whole series of roads. So you get the road up front.
Okay.
You get open competition. There's nothing hidden because now all the contractors are actually equally competing with yourselves.
Yeah.
And the 2 billion that you had set aside this year to do 10 kilometers, right? You can do 20
more road,
30
more,
40 kilometers because you've stretched the payment.
Yeah.
The payment period. It's a model that's been very successful in India, right? It opens up, it creates greater transparency, greater competition, right? Because the only factor that we're putting in there is as part of our principle of 30% going to youth and women, it's the only criteria that we've put that 30% has to be reserved for women, youth, and person with disabilities. But other than that, you compete on the basis of price, standard, and you design and build yourself. So you're, it's not the government coming to say, these are the specifications, and then you're bidding, and you don't know whether there's something's been tweaked there somewhere. And it's the same principle, for example, that we're following with the provision of healthcare. And again, we're seeing that, and we're working in that. We've gotten a lot of interest also even from American companies, because we're saying, why should government go, right? And again, put out a tender out there that I want to buy, you know, X-ray equipment, that equipment, that no capacity to maintain, which is come down there, right? Somebody has made his cut, right? Nobody bothers to maintain. So we're saying, no, we want to change that model. Let's lease this equipment. Let's work with reputable international companies, open up and float an international tender, let them provide the equipment, let them service the equipment, and it ends up being much cheaper, but not only being cheaper for government, but on top of it, you end up getting service so that people actually have those equipments being serviced, you know, in the respective hospitals. So it's just basically a new way of looking at it. Instead of having the issue of providing money for people to go there and take their cut and then they don't care what happens thereafter, by engaging private sector, by allowing private sector to take the lead, nobody is going to build a road and want that road to collapse if they are responsible for maintaining it. They will do a job because they want to conserve their profit. Thank you. Nobody will want to pay a bribe. Why should I pay you know, a bribe? I want to maximize my profit, and so long as it's done in an open, transparent manner, and the country benefits.
Thank you very much. You have educated me on that. I suppose there are several. I am sure the audience is happy that I consolidate a lot of their questions. So you be very brief. I'll take three questions at a time. I'll start with Whitney. It's Tony. Great. Yeah, Whitney, briefly. And if it's a comment, make it very brief, but then ask a question direct. And Whitney will show the example. He's a Brookings scholar.
Mr. President, my name is Whitney Schneidman, and I'm a non-resident fellow at Brookings. My question is not on Longy's list, but it's an issue that you raised, and it's China. And I think there's recognition that China has made a contribution in Africa, so in terms of investment in infrastructure in many areas. My question relates to the concerns. The way we see it here is China comes in and they don't create jobs, they don't train people, they don't create skills. All the aid is tied to Chinese products and services. My question is that a concern for you? And related to that, there's a press report this week that said that China actually is proposing to the U.S. to work together on various infrastructure projects in Africa. And they put the Inga Dam as an example. And is this something that makes sense from where you're sitting?
Tony?
I'm Tony Carroll, and I'm a senior associate down the street at CSIS, so we're warring think tanks. I'd like you to give a little bit more detail on the sub-regional elements. Will the new, under the new constitution, will the new sub-regional authorities have tax revenue generating capability? And if so, wouldn't that open up the opportunity for sub-regional infrastructure development, where if each of these authorities had revenue generating capability, the bond markets, which are fledgling but starting to show some real strength in Africa, might be willing to put together funding for a bridge or an airport or other water plant as it's done in this country?
The lady at the corner. And I just noticed that we have Shanta Devarajan, our former chief economist for Africa region. So you find a question before it's over.
Thank you very much, Mr. President.
Oh, it's Vera. I didn't know that was my other scorer, actually. I couldn't see properly. I would have skipped her.
In the context of regional integration, I just wanted to ask a very short question in terms of regional commodity markets. Coffee today in the world is such a huge price for the farmers on the continent and not. And I know that you've been working on getting a regional market. How far are you with setting up a commodity exchange in Kenya? Since it's something that I think the sub-regional EAC is talking about.
I think I would like to maybe answer those. I saw there are so many, so be brief. It's actually odd for me to tell my president how to act, so I have to apologize at some point.
I think with China, I don't think the Chinese are doing anything different than, you know, anybody else. If you want to look at it from the perspective that their finances are tied to Chinese goods and services, I mean, save for the World Bank, if we get Exim money from France, it's tied to French goods and services. If we get aid from KfW of Germany, it's tied to German goods and services. I will guarantee you, Exim here in the US will not give me money to go and buy Airbus. It'll be tied to Boeing.
to Boeing. Yeah?
So the Chinese are not doing anything
unique
that is unique from that perspective. Huh? Like I'm saying, all they're doing is just being very shrewd business people, right? Who have seen an opportunity and are taking advantage of that opportunity. And in actual fact, this is one of the things that we were saying yesterday and the day before, that it is important, for the U.S. Congress to understand that Exim money, is not money that's being given to be dished out to some backwater countries on the African continent. Exim money is tied to jobs here in the United States. Mm-hmm. And there's need for people to understand to understand that quite, you know, quite clearly. I think that's what I have to say about that particular issue. You're not going to give your money at subsidized rates if it's not going to benefit you. Not China, not the U.S., not anybody. It's always tied to that. With regard to counties, yes, they do have the capacity to raise revenue through various local taxes, right? But here we have to be careful because ultimately, whatever is borrowed by the county, is tied to the national debt. And we have to be very cautious, especially in the initial stages. Eventually, we may get to where you're saying. But until we are 100% certain that we have all the necessary financial management controls in place, it would be highly risky at this stage to allow counties to go out and borrow, especially externally, right? Without those control measures in place, because it can really rain havoc, on the overall fiscal framework of a country. So we are not, and even the framers of the Constitution themselves realize that, because they made it quite clear that at least for the next, I think it's 5 years or so, counties cannot borrow until such time that, you know, the proper public financial management systems are in place to ensure that we protect the national fiscal framework. So it's not likely to happen in the near future because we're still building institutions. But ultimately, you know, that's where we're heading. Regional Commodities Exchange, yes, we're working on it, and we're working on it very seriously. We have a great champion I see sitting at the back who has really done a lot of work towards putting together this Regional Commodities Exchange. And we are very supportive of that move. We believe it will strongly benefit our farmers. We believe it will ensure that the person who actually sweats gets the best possible price for his or her sweat. Rwanda has managed to conclude theirs. We are in the process through the Northern Corridor framework of working out how we can ultimately create, you know, a regional exchange, because we realize there is merit in size. So we are working on those details, and it is indeed my hope, because it's to be raised at the next summit, that we should be able to conclude this particular issue very, very soon.
Okay, thank you very much. I'm going to go to this side for now, and I'll come back this side. The two ladies and Betty. So three ladies.
Hello.
I've been brief, yeah.
Thank you, Mr. President, for being here and for discussing with us. My name is Rose Mutiso. I'm from Nairobi. I'm also a young person, and this is, I guess, a Mwangi question. I'm really eager to hear what strategies you have in place for young people in Kenya. We're an exploding population, growing. A lot of us are entering into the workforce at some point. What is our outlook? What can we aspire to in terms of job opportunities, and, you know, in a context of scarce resources and what seems to be a very tough future for us?
The one behind.
My name is Chikulupi Kasaka in the Mandela Washington Fellow from Tanzania. My question goes, terrorism has been a threat all over East Africa, and we've seen witnessing bombings in Arusha. So what's the role of EAC in ensuring border security? And my second question goes to, with Power Africa, what's the initiative are you going to implement your program on distributing laptops in primary schools? So how are we going to implement this?
Betty.
Thank you. My name is Betty Maina from Kenya as well. Thank you, Mr. President, for coming on this visit, because it's given an opportunity for many business people to also join you in this regard. And many of us have been here and learned a lot. And you've picked on some of the tensions of the week that I'd like your take on. The perceptions that we have been that we have confronted about Africa here are quite different. Africa to us is 54 countries, but to the U.S. business, it's one country. There is very little difference, or even when we try to speak a lot, it's, you know, they think we're just little states within the big country, like, you know, the, like in the U.S. And therefore, and also in our own presentation of Africa, because of our small sizes and small economies, we've also presented ourselves as one to be able to have a better critical mass. But what is your take with that tension between being separate and yet one? The challenge of dealing with perceptions about Ebola, which is a West African challenge at this time, but it affects all of us. And we've seen the tensions as well this week. We were presenting ourselves as one continent, but when we've gone for pitches, I think we've done in some of the meetings, separate countries just do individual pitches. They don't do continental or regional pitches. So I think it's pretty much of a confusion for us. It's important that we present ourselves as one large mass. But there is attraction in separation so that we can say we are not Ebola infested, we're East Africa. No? So, I mean, what is your take about how we're going to both work collectively but present the separate promise of individual countries? Thank you.
Okay, Mr. President, those three. I'll go probably to another three. I can see the foreign cabinet secretary looking at me, and since they kept time, I'm going also to keep time.
The most important thing first is to acknowledge, as my young sister there has said, that indeed, yes, young people are our greatest resource. Yeah. Yeah? And at the same time, they are our greatest challenge. Yeah, given the fact that we have indeed the youngest population in the world,
yeah.
Right? And therefore our need to focus. What are we doing in Kenya? In Kenya, we're trying to see how we can, and we're beginning to institutionalize some of those things.
Yeah.
How do we create opportunities for our young people? We're trying to set aside funds and training for young people, yeah, who can access funds at a very low cost,
yeah,
to be able to start up their respective businesses. A good number are beginning to take advantage of that across the country. This is something that we are going through and want to test. We have set aside, again, the same realization as I was talking about the annuity program. 30% of total government procurement we have set aside and said that this can only be accessed by women, young people, and persons with disability. Again, in an attempt to get them to grow. We're trying to restructure our national youth service so that it can become a home, a breeding ground to provide people with skills, right, that they require in life. We're looking at amending and changing our curriculum to make it more appropriate to the kind of challenges and opportunities that a new changing world is providing. So these are just some of the things that we're trying to see how we include and incorporate youth in the social economic development agenda of the country. So we want to engage, we recognize the challenge that the youth pose, but we want to see how we can convert that challenge into an opportunity for Kenya and the continent as a whole. With regard to the issue of EAC, as I said, the threat of terrorism is not just regional, it's an international problem. But we are trying to work together under the framework of the EAC. We are meeting regularly. We have, what do you call your body? The East African, what is it called? The sectorial group on. So you have the meeting that we hold, everyone, where we are trying to address ourselves to those particular challenges. We're trying to see how we can come up with a common. We're trying to come up with a common. Immigration system, whereby we are trying to integrate our national IDs so that we know who our people are on a digital platform, so that you know who are your citizens. We are working on mutual intelligence sharing. We have a new intelligence center, joint intelligence center for the region that is being established. We recognize that we need a joint approach. Terrorists who hit Kenya sometimes pass through Uganda, sometimes have taken their boats across to Pemba, into Tanga, through to Arusha, to hit Tanzania. So we recognize that this threat requires a common approach, and we are working together to deal with that. With regard to the issue of laptops, we are committed to that particular program. We are going to continue to pursue it. We are facing procurement challenges, but we have said we don't want to fast track it. We don't want to do it outside the process. We will go through the process. But with regard to the program of powering and preparing our primary and secondary schools, we are well on track, and we believe that by next year, December, we will be in a position formally announced that every single primary school, every single secondary school in the Republic of Kenya will be on the grid, powered grid, as we continue working towards implementing our laptop program.
Betty's question was on the continent and brief.
The truth of the matter, yes, we are more than 50 countries in one continent, and the perception is one country as opposed to 52 countries, right? On the one hand, we want to sell ourselves individually, but I think with growing recognition, we're understanding the importance of the need to sell ourselves as a region. Precisely what we did this morning with the EAC meeting that we had at the Chamber of Commerce. And selling our region and our projects and our programs together. We still have that national idea. But I believe with each passing day, right, and especially with what we are trying to fast track, especially within the EEC, there is growing recognition, yeah, that it makes more sense for us to sell ourselves, you know, as a region, to sell ourselves as a single market, right? And when it comes to the issue of perception, yeah, which is what I was saying, if you want to take Ebola, Ebola is not, we'll get there, Ebola is not an African problem. It's not a West African problem, yeah? It is a problem for mankind, you know, wherever you are, yeah? And I think education and more regular interactions as we're having now will go a long way towards getting people to understand who Africa is, what Africa is about, yeah? And the constituent parts, yeah? But that responsibility will largely lie on us to sell that positive story, to sell the identity, and for us to recognize that our individual identity does not mean our inability to collectively, you know, work together. Yeah? It is not going to be an easy challenge, and, you know, and it's been there, and it has been there. It has its historic context and boundaries that were put together by people who don't know, who died long before.
Yeah.
Right? But these are challenges that we must recognize. We respected those boundaries at the time of independence, but we must recognize that those boundaries should not be obstacles to helping us achieve what we need to achieve as individual countries and as a continent as a whole.
Thank you very much. I'm going to take three questions, but we promised to release the president exactly at 5:30. He may give us 2 minutes over. But I'm going to go to Prof there. Yes, that, yeah. Then I'm going to ask Chris to speak next, for so long as it's not more than that a minute, because the president will be late. And the last question will come from Shanta. Okay. Yes. That's,
thank you, Mark. That's, Ian Gary from Oxfam. And in February, Oxfam and Brookings collaborated on an event on the East African oil and gas boom. So my question is related to oil in Kenya. One of the major themes in managing this resource will be transparency and accountability. When we had the conference in February, the chairman of Tullo Oil said that they are more than willing disclose their petroleum agreements in every country of operation. They've done so in Ghana. My question to you is, would you be willing to collaborate with Tullo and disclose your petroleum agreements?
Okay, that's on the...
Can I just answer that and just say, absolutely. In fact, the law that is before Parliament is seeking to address precisely that, so that it is quite clear from day one, yeah? What is in those agreements, and we're even going a stage further to include public participation in the development of that draft bill, so that we ensure maximum transparency. We have all seen the problems that have arisen in many parts of the African continent as a result of that lack of transparency, and we want to ensure that we get it right from square one.
Chris.
Your Excellency, as a practitioner in Kenya, I just like to talk to you to tell you that we have a company. 2 years ago, our share value was about 13 bob. Hardly 2 years ago. Today, our share value price is 50 bob. This is voting with confidence because of your policy. And I think that's why I like always to say something, because I am centered in Kenya. We are now going into agriculture, energy, medical, education.
Chris, I'm going to cut you.
Please don't. I really feel people here need to listen to the people who are on the ground. I think it's very important when the president talks, he's not just talking. He means what he says and does what he says. Thank you.
Thank you very much. There seems to be a... If it's very short, then Shanta will conclude this meeting, the questioning. Very brief. Because you don't have to answer those two.
Mr. President, thank you for your comments on XM. I chair the U.S. XM Africa Committee and sit with a number of others on the USTR Committee. So it's an AGOA question. There's a lot of concern on the congressional side about the economic partnership agreements with European countries, and it's kind of negatively affecting the discussion on reauthorization of AGOA. So what would you say to members of Congress on how we can balance those two things and still keep the forward movement on AGOA going forward? Thank you.
Okay, Shanta.
Well, my question was partially asked already, and you answered most of it, which is about the oil sector. The experience of oil producers in Africa is quite sobering. There's been huge problems, both on the revenue side, which is what the other question was about, but also on the expenditure side. And so my question is, what are you doing to make sure that in the case of Kenya, this actually turns out to be a real...
Sorry, if you can just say that again.
Spending part.
What are you doing to make sure that the oil era in Kenya will be a successful one when there's been so many problems in previous oil in countries in Africa in their experience with oil?
Okay, Mr. President. Thank you.
I think the first thing I have to say, if I just address that first, is you've got to look at this in context of where Kenya is today. All right? Like I said, under our new framework, we have now got our sub-counties who are very clear, yeah, in their role and have been very active in promoting issues that are of interest to them. They are, number one, your first safeguard to ensure, first and foremost, they will not agree to anything. And if you followed the news, you've seen how active, for example, Turkana County has been in wanting clearly to understand step by step, not just taking what the national government is saying, right? Two, we are also equally very clear that if we are to successfully exploit in a sustainable manner those resources, we are not going to be able to do so unless we clearly are able to take into account local communities in the area. We're not going to be able to do so without taking into account the counties where those resources are. We're not going to be able to do so without taking into account the national interest, because Kenyans, wherever they are determined to know. And ultimately, we're not going to be able to do so without being able to take care of the interests of our investment partners. With the kind of civil society that we have in the country, with the kind of media freedoms that we currently have in the country, we are not going to be able to take a single step without Kenyans at every single level demanding to see what is tied in those agreements. In fact, this is one of the reasons it's taken so long to conclude some of these issues. So I think for Kenya anyway, and I don't want to speak for anybody else, but for Kenya, the era of being able to do anything without scrutiny is literally over. Yeah? I'll give you just a recent example. I mean, we're in the process of recruiting new police officers, right? 10,000 new police officers. Whereas ordinarily it would have just proceeded. Yeah? We're now stuck, including in court battles, right? as to the process that was used in identifying those 10,000, right? And so the era of actually just doing something and it's non-existent. And this is why I keep emphasizing the point of let's understand that we need to change the record, because Kenyans have replaced that record and are actually right now on YouTube. You know, they moved on. Yeah, it's quite clear. It's impossible. Yeah, no matter how much you may try. I think with regard, it's a challenge. But I think it's important to address that challenge from this particular perspective. AGOA has been there, right? For whatever reason, on both sides, we have not taken full advantage of that. And where are we? What we're trying to do is to establish, develop, grow new markets. And we've got to be able to understand that we need to give AGOA another chance, because we are negotiating EPAs on the basis that we have had long-standing trade arrangements that are substantial, yeah, especially with Europe. And that cannot be transformed overnight. Here, we're at a development stage. And even those EPAs are also increasingly becoming difficult to negotiate because of very clear, we're not at the same level as we were when we first, when we were discussing the original, called, ACP?
ACP is the Rome.
Yeah? And I think this is the understanding that we would want, you know, lawmakers in this country to understand, right? That America is playing catch up in many ways, yeah, right, and today cannot necessarily look around the same considerations. Yeah, you've got to first establish the links, and I think what AGOA was supposed to do was to open up that capacity for us to be able to do more business with each other. Let's establish the business and then start talking about, you know, those harder principles. Huh? It's very difficult to compare. You know? If it is Europe, you know, our entire floriculture, it is dependent on the European market. Yeah?
Thank you.
We've got to look at it from that particular perspective.
Yeah. Thank you very much. And I would like to add that we have a couple of people here like Tony Whitney, who have been testifying in Congress on that issue, and they are very good supporters of Africa. The Africa Growth Initiative has testified in Congress on this issue. So on our part, we are trying to help from this side. Now, let me make two announcements. Well, the first one is that we've been instructed that you stay there until the president exits. So you just stay seated. I believe the cabinet secretaries will follow and the ambassador. The other one I would like to say to you, Mr. President, is to thank you very much. One thing is I'm very proud personally as an African and as a Kenyan. When we get a president who does not evade any question and is knowledgeable and actually educates us, so it's quite unusual and commendable that every question that we asked, including, again, I had to go and study, you are able to deal with this and educate us. And so we are very, and this at Brookings, we tend to be fairly tough. And so I really commend you for that. And I think we are going there. And I would like to support, so Chris, by the way, I was not trying to stop you. I knew where you are going, but I think we see this movement and we are looking forward. I guess it's the first time I have a president who is younger than me. and so I can see what the young people can do. So we are very happy, Mr. President, and we appreciate that very much. So we can take, I'm sure. Yeah.